Let's see if we can find some interesting common ground here from people, questions.
Can I make
already?
A comment first just to connect up the talks? So, Phil, I didn't know what Phil was going to talk about, but it turns out that your story fits in beautifully with the whole neuroeconomic story because of the discount factor. Mm-hmm. So, back up a bit. Dopamine is not the only neuromodulator in the brain. There's another one called serotonin. And serotonin, it turns out, the level of activity of serotonin is a very strong predictor of behavior, and especially if it's low risk-taking behavior. And if it's high, you tend to be high in the social scale. In monkeys, the highest levels are in the alpha male. And there's a very good model now that we have called temporal difference learning, which accounts for the dopamine signal. But there's an extra parameter in it. So recall that I said that dopamine predicts whether the stimulus will give you a future reward, but I didn't say how far into the future, right? And now the question is, do you account for the next moment as being more important than the next day or the next year? And that discount factor, is now there's evidence that that may well be the serotonin level.
The extent.
Yeah, the extent to which you're willing. In other words, if the discount factor is one, then it means that whether I get it today or tomorrow is no different. And so therefore, I'll wait the future. I can integrate over the entire future. But if the discount factor is zero, then tomorrow's reward is worth nothing to me. I will take whatever I have now. And you can manipulate that in experiments. And you can show, for example, if you give them a task that requires going through several negative, you have a choice. You can either go down one path, which is a lot of small positives, or if you're willing to take a couple hits first, negatives, there's a much bigger positive reward. Right. And depending on what your serotonin level is, you'll either go one way or the other.
Yeah. There's a book by George Ainsley, has done a lot of work on this hyperbolic discounting. Can anybody elaborate on that a little bit for me?
I mean, is it called Breakdown of the Will?
Yes.
Yes, yeah. You've described it well.
That's okay. Fine.
And also, I saw a nice paper in Science about 6 months ago in which in humans, they manipulated serotonin levels, and they showed this modulated people's likelihood of taking unfair offers in the ultimatum game, this game I use to measure generosity. So people who had lower serotonin levels were much more present-oriented. They said, whatever you're giving me, I'll take it. I don't want to reject this for some longer-term benefit of sending you a signal of punishment. So I think there's very good convergent evidence there.
And that's in Science?
That's in Science.
Yeah. Yeah, Terry, could I just ask you one little technical question?
Okay.
Why would, you sort of said as you went through this, nobody had thought of varying the reward for years. Why not? I mean, what on earth would people keep on doing the same experiment?
Well, I think it's because we all get into a rut, into our routine, and everybody does it this way. All the previous experiments have been done this way, and therefore you don't even think of changing it. And it required a real mind shift, one of these insights. That, what if we give it a different reward, not just, it turns out that monkeys also have preferences. For example, some like grape juice better than orange juice. And so that will also be reflected in the neurons. Mm-hmm. The neurons in the parietal cortex reflect how much reward you're getting in terms of the number of drops, the quality of the reward, some juices are better than others, and the probability of reward. It's really remarkable. Mm-hmm.
Right, it's just that, I'm just wondering what the monkey was just reporting for duty every day, and there was no change in the reward. What's it doing? It just seemed to make no sense. But
so, Roger, would you call
George Coob is at the back there, waiting for a microphone.
Well, there's another reason why reward wasn't varied, and that's because of the heavy behavioristic influence on American psychology, such that reward was not a word that was even used. It was reinforcement, and reinforcement was the probability, increase in the probability of response, and it was all contingencies of reinforcement. So focal vision, the narrowing of vision had to do with that historical fact as well. And ethology wasn't really studied that much in the United States. It came from Europe.
So a parallel development in economics is that of revealed preferences, so using previous choice to predict.
Yeah,
current choice.
Thanks. I actually didn't know. I just wanted to show that how different shifts in science do happen.
So we would call this rational rationality. So again, the organizing principle always is evolution, and the brain itself is an economic organ. It has goals, it has limited resources to affect those goals, and as Terry said, it will only affect those goals in a way that allows a species to reach its ultimate goals of survival and reproduction. It's not going to run at 1,000% capacity or 100% capacity at all times because why waste the resources?
So let's go through the panel one by one. What did you think when you saw what what happened over the last 2 weeks, this sort of meltdown. I mean, did you actually have any practical application of what you were to seeing what people were doing? Did you say, oh, I know why they're doing that? Or did you say, oh, my God, why are they doing that? Or how do we explain that? What?
It seems like a lot of hurting to me. It seems like there's a great overreaction because of the uncertainty in the world. We are uncertainty averse. We don't like uncertainty. And I think this is kind of my personal view, only informed by the information you guys have, not any special information, is that we're uncertainty averse and I'd rather write a big check and get rid of the uncertainty. The markets certainly want that. As you see, the market's moving around, whether the bailout's approved or not approved. So I think this actually can be dangerous. This is where I think the brain science is important. If you know that your brain is set up to take the certain payoff, even if it's more expensive, then you should be able to suppress that. So I think there's a great overreaction.
Well, yeah. I guess what I'm trying to get at is if with the work that's now being done in neuroeconomics, people coming into labs, people lying in scanners, various fMRI experiments and so on, how does this advance as beyond the movie Wall Street and Greed is Good? I mean, what do we now know that's of subtly different and useful information?
Yeah, well, I'm not answering the neuros. You want to go. Several things are really important. Given a complex issue, one of the things that we have ignored is that from the 1990s, our government has pushed to make every American a homeowner. And every American can't afford to be a homeowner because it's expensive to own a home. And that's really been a push from top down. There's, I think, in 1990, maybe 60% of Americans own a home, and a goal of many presidential administrations was to up that to 70. So there was a general push on the market to give loans. And as I said, you know, it was rational before. You gave some loans. You didn't give loans where there was such high risk. And then it got to be where it was, as I said, in the commons dilemma, where they fished every sardine out of the sea in Monterey, where everybody is in for the kill. And you know at some rational level that if we all take all the sardines out that we can each day, at some point the resource will be depleted. And there was warnings all along saying, you know, there are not enough reserves to cover your loans. And, you know, all these places, people say, yes, but he's doing it. Yes, but he's doing it. And why should I drop out and go for the low yield? And so it was a funny kind of mass conformity going toward the irrational, going toward what I'm saying is this present-oriented, very short-term decision. It'll get better in the future, that somehow it'll work out. You know, and we saw this with Bear Stearns. We saw this with Enron. But this is the first time we've seen it at this mass level of dozens and dozens, well, hundreds of banks and loan institutions all in it, all in for the kill.
I think it's hard to control the markets, but it's not hard to control your reaction to the markets. And so I think one thing that neuroeconomics adds is an individual perspective on decision making. I think we're getting the tools to predict individual decisions. Those tools suggest that gain is not the opposite of loss, that there are two different systems at least. And they also suggest that emotions do play a role in economic decision making. And what that means is that if, for instance, right now, because there's so much risk and uncertainty that I perceive, I want to take all my stocks, I want to try to liquidate all my stocks, right? I may want to think about that. Now, there are people in the world of finance that are masters at this. One of them is Warren Buffett. He's buying companies now, okay? So you can watch their example, but what I think we will get is a mechanistic sort of model of individual decision-making, and I hope that can help individuals to inform their own decisions.
Terry?
My reaction was to really ask what was happening, what really changed, because it all happened very rapidly, right? It was within a few weeks that this came up. I mean, it built up very slowly, mm-hmm. And then why was it so rapid? Why was it so shift so dramatic? And in a sense, you know, nothing has changed. The instruments are all there, and everybody knows, just as they did before, that there are these toxic investments. But somehow the psychology shifted from, you know, you're doing it and why can't I do it, to, oh, I don't trust you anymore. Mm-hmm. And now I'm not only not going to buy these instruments anymore, I'm not going to let you borrow money from me anymore.
Right, right.
And that's what freezes things up. And isn't it, that's a psychological shift. And it's a mass shift. It's like everybody suddenly decided not to trust anybody else. It's not just here in the U.S., it's all over the world now.
That's right.
So
somebody sucked the oxytocin out of the room.
That's right. And I think that there must be brain systems that sort of can rapidly shift when the conditions change. And it's all psychology. It's not like anything else has changed in the world at that moment. You know, it'll take years to wind down. But suddenly, you know, we have to make this. Why is it that we had to pass this legislation this week? I mean, nobody ever explained. Why can't we discuss this for a few weeks? I mean, what's the reasoning there? I didn't see anything in the papers about, well, you know, if we don't do it this week, then the world's going to fall. But, you know, it's not clear.
Well, I think it's clear. There's an election coming up in about, 5 weeks?
Yeah. Just a minute. There was also a PNAS paper recently, again, this has bearing on this, researchers at Cambridge looking at testosterone levels of traders on Wall Street. It was also reported in the Wall Street Journal, which caused some fairly rapid shifts in instabilities in the market. And at the end of the paper, and certainly in press interviews, the person who did the research, although he was not advocating this and being careful about saying it, said that he thought it would be different, talking about the testosterone level in the room, if there were more older traders and more female traders in that room, because that would change the dynamic in the room. It's an interesting thought.
A short comment, anecdote, it might be interest you. We did use method that we use for analyzing recording, echo recording or subdural recording of epileptic patients. So we did correlations between the stocks and between the stocks and the index. And one of the things that you see, which is quite interesting, that the stock market all along, it started about 4 or 5 years ago, starts to behave very much like epileptic brain. When you have episodes of pre-seizures, of short periods of high correlation, very high correlation between the stocks. And if you analyze it, it seems that this high correlation are mainly attributed to the fact that each stock has a very high correlation with the index. If you subtract it, the correlations between the stocks are much lower. And one of the things that you mentioned some of the things about the stress and decision-making and the connection of other people. So I wonder if people did experiments, like in the first lecture, that you have reward, but in addition to having the reward, you also, the subject gets information about what other subjects are doing. Mm. So to imitate more closely the situation of the market, that you have a single subject tested, but it has information about other subjects as if they are tested at the same time. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a great area of research. It's sort of going from expected value theory or expected utility theory to game theory. Paul knows more about this. Mm-hmm. But actually, there are quite a few people looking at these game theoretic types of dilemmas and situations using fMRI and other methods. I'll let Paul say more about that.
And what you find in that is what you would expect, which is people acclimate to what the group is doing. So if the group are being selfish, will be selfish. If the group is being cooperative, will be cooperative. That particularly helps if you have a lever. If I can ding the guy who's not behaving nice, he'll get in line almost all the time, except for my 2% sociopaths. They never get in line. Yeah, absolutely. So real money's on the table and exchanging hands. So you see a lot of this kind of herding behavior. And, you know, we're a social species, and we develop these brains when we learn from other people. And it really makes sense that, particularly in areas we don't know a lot about, financial markets, they want to see what other people are doing. Having said that, I think, you know, the fourth horse of the financial apocalypse is the taxi driver signal. So I remember being in New York City in 1999, and the taxi driver who took me from the airport was telling me about the stocks he was buying. The same thing happened here in California, in which, everybody, the gardener, my gardener had three houses. Mm-hmm. This is a classic definition of a bubble, because he doesn't know why he's buying houses, just everyone has to do it because prices seem to be going up. And again, there's only so far that tail of the distribution can go, things crash. So I think, as Terry said, I think that is just a part of human nature, that we're so focused on social behaviors, we see what the other humans are doing, it must be smart, I'm not sure what to do, I'll do what the other humans are doing, that leads to these inevitable crashes. I don't know if we can change that. Maybe this is a question for Dr. Lombardo.
Well, one of the things that when you're talking about that a lot of behavior is ultimately geared towards survival, on the other hand, you're all talking about a pleasure principle, which is really not essential to survival. It's over and above what I have to do to survive, You know, I want it to taste good. I want it to feel good. I want it to be fuzzy rather than rough. So I think there, you know, again, you know, pleasure centers in the brain from Oldham Miller, that I think at some deep level we know if I have to do this, it's going to help me survive. It's going to help me pass on my genes. But there's some other mechanism which is really geared toward how do I get the most pleasure out of life. It's not just a gain loss thing. It's, you know, I want to enjoy whatever it is. I want to. So I think it's the hedonistic part that we all have some of, and essentially it's. And I think every once in a while we slip out of the rational economic decision making, gene replicating mentality to say, I want to have fun, and I think we have not given that enough place in our view of human nature.
Mike Collins at the bank there.
Yes, a comment on the interesting discussion on market behavior, which I think is very, very interesting. And I picked up some things. I happen to make my living in the stock market, and I picked up some things from guys that haven't been making it very well lately. But one of the things that's happening is about there are times, sometimes extending over periods of several days, when most of the volume is being generated by various artificial intelligence experiments in some cases. They refer to it as algorithmic trading. It's something that myself and another fellow here in La Jolla have experimented with. Mm-hmm. So I think it'd be interesting to, when we're thinking about group behavior and we're thinking about how artificial intelligence is going to be affecting civilization in the future, it's an interesting experimental ground here on a daily basis when you're getting sometimes as much as 50 or 60% of the volume being generated by various dueling computers, if you will.
So many of my friends in machine learning, and I am the president of a foundation that actually runs a big meeting that has over 800 participants every year. Who are the people who are programming those machines, and what they tell me is absolutely fascinating. Which you're absolutely right that it can be completely automated, and with these algorithms, you can basically keep track minute by minute. And the key is to be right there when new information comes in, so you can take advantage of it. So you have to be actually on the floor or have connected with the company. Delayed information is just no good.
Well,
which is what we get.
The other thing we have now is these vast baskets of securities that can be triggered to hit the floor.
Right.
The minute the the computer.
It's is second by second
to the order flow to the floor.
But here's what they also tell me, which I think is really fascinating. They say that the algorithms, you train them up on past data, and you do that to predict the future. And inexplicably, suddenly, for reasons that no one can understand, suddenly the algorithms go sour. They don't work anymore. And that's one of these shifts that occur in psychology, right? In other words, there's an additional element that has not reflected by what's happened in the past, which now has shifted everybody's goals or expectations, and now you have to start from scratch. You say, okay, now I have to wait and look and see what's happening and come up with a new algorithm. And it's not just one, by the way. They have hundreds, and they have to weight them depending on optimize the return.
Since I've got the microphone, I'm going to be selfish for just a second and ask a question related to your discussion on morality. Over the years, when you see an article in the paper of someone from a low income situation who finds the $50,000 in the paper bag on the bus seat, and turns it in, so therefore behaving in a way that's notable. An after effect of that is getting very nasty phone calls, anonymous calls. That's anecdotal. I don't know whether it's true or not, but I've always thought it was notable that sometimes very good behavior pisses people off sometimes.
Right.
Anybody have a comment on that?
Proportionally, poor people give more money to charity, charity broadly understood, including friends and family, than wealthier people. So I think there's perhaps more of a culture of giving because you're more at survival level. You actually need to depend on your neighbors more than maybe some of us in this room do. Interestingly, my writing partner's book is British, and I was on the phone with him a couple of days ago, and he was crying. He's a very creative writing guy.
We don't cry.
And there's a British TV show that was handing out awards to citizens who had done heroic deeds, and the presenters were Beckham and Michael Caine and these very famous people. So somehow we have developed these institutions to lionize people who go to great risk or great expense to help others. I think that's an interesting behavior. Why would we do that? Why do we care that the truck driver pulled his partner out of the truck that was on fire? That actually is very compelling. I think that's the kind of binding agent that we see that Thomas presents to us.
Yeah, I want to just follow up on that. It's a slight tangent. As you mentioned, Peter mentioned, I've been enmeshed in evil, the Stanford Prison Study. I was an expert witness in Abu Ghraib prison situation. And I wrote a book, The Lucifer Effect. But now I'm getting out of the evil game and I'm focusing on heroes, the sense that heroes are the antidote to evil. And the notion is, in order to be consistent, I'm arguing that most evil is done by ordinary people put in a situation that pushes them in that direction. And therefore, I have to argue that most heroes are ordinary people who are in the same exact situation that's pushing some to become villains, and they choose the heroic thing. We know nothing about the heroic decision moment. That everything we know in the psychology of heroism is really retrospective interviews of Christians who helped Jews, you know, weeks, months, years later. And so this is where I think scanning can come in. I mean, essentially, not only moral decision making, but really in the scanner, putting people in a situation where they have to, because to be a hero means you're behaving sociocentrically on behalf of someone else. You're taking an action knowing that the costs to you are probably higher than the gains. That is, for me to be a hero, it's you're doing something where you know whether you're a whistleblower, you know, whether you're taking a physical risk. You know, and there are impulsive heroes and reflective heroes. Like whistleblowers are reflective. You have to collect data versus you jump on a railroad track to save somebody. But we really, as far as I know, all the literature I've looked at, we know nothing about what goes in the brains of people who are anticipating to do or not to do, take action or not take action. So for me, this is really, it would be an exciting area for people like you guys with a free, empty scanner.
I think all the prediction, reward, decision-making, risk stuff, I think we'll find that being elaborated a little bit more in the next session as well. We're running a bit late, so we should probably go to a break at this point. If you can come back in 10 minutes, that'd be great. Thank you to the panel.